Good morning, everyone. We're continuing with our discussion of how to live intuitively, which is actually I'm very glad that we started this, and I'm glad that we titled it the way we did. It's a picking up the conversation of intuitive guidance from a slightly different angle, and just the thought of not merely how to receive guidance, but how to live in a slightly different way. I think it's a more expansive way to think about it. So I'm glad that we stumbled upon it. So let's start now with a prayer. Heavenly Father, Divine Mother, Friend, Beloved God, Jesus Christ, Babaji Krishna, Lahiri Mahashaya, Swami Sri Yukteswar, Beloved Master Paramahansa Yogananda, Saints of all religions, humbly we bow to you all. Dear Swamiji, help us to keep our attention on the light before us, to turn our backs on all the distracting thoughts and energies that try to take us away from the one true goal of life. We are here to be your instruments of divine love into the world. How we do that, what form, where, is of very little importance compared to the simple fact of opening ourselves to be your channel. Guide us and bless us that we may be able to live in harmony with that single intention. Om, peace. Amen. I remember Swami made a comment once. I don't remember what the context was, but he said it like this. He said, I'm different than other people. He said, I am the most careful about how I treat the people who are closest to me. And he commented that it often happens that people, you know, become enamored of what it is they're trying to accomplish in the world, and they become careless about attending to their closest relationships. Swami said he's always the most attentive to the closest, and he proved it. I saw him every day, sometimes for a period of years, and I spent periods of time with him traveling and visiting in his home and so on. It's the truth. He was always exceedingly attentive and always courteous, careful, energetic. He never brushed off the people who were around him because he was busy doing something else. I mean, he was reasonable. He had work to do. He didn't just hang around and chat with everyone. But the courtesy and the concern, I think the word courtesy is actually the word I want to use. It was always there. He always was aware that we all had feelings, and that it was necessary for him to go about his work, and it was necessary for him to not let our quibbling concerns at times interfere. But nonetheless, there was always this great care that he exercised. There was a period of 7 years when he was married. He took on the marriage basically to show Ananda that it was possible to be a householder and still be deeply devoted. But he was, I was thinking about this recently. He was a wonderful husband. I mean, he was so courteous and so kind and so cooperative with what his wife needed. It was a very, very, very good example for those who had ears to hear and eyes to see. And it did turn the whole community around. It gave people in the community, this was at the beginning of the 80s, permission to follow their inner inclinations. The community was reaching the point where people were falling into that worst of all possible spiritual, I'll call it a heffalump trap, after the Pooh, Winnie the Pooh stories, the heffalump trap that we would fall into, which was people were asking, what should I do? If I'm serious on the path, this is what I should do, instead of saying, what does God want me to do? And Swamiji, who'd been a monk, who was made a monk by Master, had been a monk for 40 years, suddenly became a householder. And he said, because he felt Master, that's what Master wanted him to do. And it allowed all of us, I wrote all about this in my book, Lightbearer, it allowed all of us to ask ourselves, not what should I do, but what do I actually feel to do? In other words, who am I? Not who am I trying to be and trying to appear and behave in a certain way that I gather from the outside and then paste on top of myself. But in the spontaneous, natural flow of my own energy and a realistic and an honest acceptance of my own strengths and weaknesses, my own limitations, my own inner needs, what does God want me to do? And as a consequence, the monastery had just been swelling. I mean, like there were 60 monks and nuns, and it wasn't really a natural lifestyle for most of them. It doesn't mean that it wasn't good for people to discipline themselves to that life. It's a very good discipline, and you learn a tremendous amount about yourself when you're making that kind of effort. So it's a very, very good thing, at least for a period of time. If not for a whole life, it's also a very good thing for a whole life if it's expansive for you to do that. For some people, it becomes more and more contractive, as Swami said. Instead of becoming lighter and lighter, people become tighter and tighter, which was a very simple way to put it. I said to him in that same conversation, sir, what's the downside then of becoming a householder? Specifically, I think we were talking about celibacy or lack of celibacy. He said, well, if you don't live a celibate life, it gives you the idea, it reinforces the idea that desires are there to be satisfied. He said, and once you start down that road, it's a long, slippery slope. But he wasn't saying that was inevitable. I had just asked him, compare the two points of view for me. But nonetheless, it doesn't really matter whether it's a slippery slope. If it's a slippery slope, we have to learn to navigate. We're not going to master it by refusing to deal with it if it's really our next stage of reality. So last time we talked, I was talking about the spider and who we are and Divine Mother's point of view. And so I wanted to continue with that a little bit. There's I'll talk about it from education for children for a beginning point. Our education for life schools are so subtle, our living wisdom schools, which is education for life, is a very broad title for all these many innovative educational ideas that came from Master, through Swami, through Nitai, through Helen, through Rose, through all the different principals and teachers. I mean, there's a long, long name that I could draw there. I was thinking both of Rose Atwell and also of Rose Neal, who was the principal, the leader, the director of the school in Portland for a long time, just because I realized there's two prominent Roses in our educational system. And I would name Rose and every Kishama, Kabir. I mean, there's so many I have to stop because otherwise, you know, the rest of the program, I'll just making sure I don't miss someone. But all of these ideas that have been developed, very, very broad education for life, living wisdom schools are the Ananda branch of education for life as a whole. We used to call them Ananda schools, but it was impossible to persuade people it was not a parochial school. Meaning if we were trying to make little tiny self-realizationists out of all these people, and we're not. We're trying to awaken people to their own inner reality. Now let me think where I was going with this. Oh yes. What we do is very subtle, and I'm very involved in our school here, more on as a supporting board member now than any other involvement. But we sometimes it's just very hard to explain because it's very subtle. It's a whole different consciousness when you're working with children. But many of the aspects of it have been and are very common in popular education. One of them is building a child's self-esteem. In other words, giving a child a sense of his own worth in the world. And when we were first starting our school, we went on little field trips to some of the better known schools in the area, the private schools that had good reputations. And they have good reputations for what they're trying to do. They're not education for life. I wish they were. And here was this perfect example. They had self-esteem was one of their units in their elementary school. And so outside one of the classrooms, there was a self-esteem tree. And the bare branches were there. And then every child had a leaf, and they would paste this leaf on the tree to show that they had self-esteem, like this. There were about 30 leaves on that tree. I read every one of them, 29, or all but one, dealt with an external accomplishment. You know, I'm the captain of the soccer team. I got all A's on my math test. I got first chair in the orchestra. I'm the first violinist in the school orchestra. The captain of the soccer team. Every single one of them was an external accomplishment. One leaf said, I'm not as moody as I used to be. But what's going to happen to those kids when they get downsized? What's going to happen when they're 40 and they hate their job, or their boss hates them and he conspires against them and lets them go, or there's an economic crash and all of a sudden you can't pay the mortgage on that fancy home? If your self-esteem is what you've been able to accomplish outwardly, you are absolutely vulnerable. You've accomplished nothing, just nothing. And you know, it's so self-evident from a certain point of view, and so not self-evident from another. I mean, at least they're trying. God bless them, they're trying. And I respect that, and there's a tremendous amount of good work that's being done. I don't want to have to, I don't want people to think there's no good educators in the world. Of course there are. But this is a revolution. Now, I'm going to bring it back to us. We tend to think of guidance in terms of we have some special mission from God. We're that little spider on the typewriter. We're just as spunky as we could be, and we're just going to go out there. I mean, the ludicrousness of the spider was that he was master of all he could survey, and he was just, so proud of himself. But he was just a tiny little spider on my typewriter. He had no command over the universe. He was incredibly vulnerable, and his options were really quite few, even though he thought he was really, God's gift to spiderhood. And for all I know, he was, He could have been the most popular little spider in his nest. I don't know. Sometimes in the world that I live in, I'm sharing what Swamiji gave to me of master's teachings all these years. In a very tiny little pond, I my little leaf waves a little bit, but it's just like, it's this tiny little pond that I live in. I believe in it because it's what I was born to do. But as I was saying last time, I'm no different than that little spider just running around in my little world. But you see, we're all no different than that spider. Because from the perspective of Swami put it really beautifully when he was talking about Master. He said, Master shows us what it is to be a human being. I mean, he shows us why we were born. And that's the level of consciousness from which one can actually say that I've accomplished something. Now, of course, all of us are moving toward it. We're moving toward it whether we're conscious of it or not. All sentient beings are as the river being drawn to the sea. That's what we are. We're just all moving like that. Swami commented once that spiritual pride is very difficult to overcome because you actually have something to be proud of. It's not just money and wealth and fame and praise and whatever it might be, which is just going to blow in the wind and turn against you in the next 1 minute. But if you have really learned something spiritually, you really have accomplished something. So here's where I am with this. The masters look at us, and we may have a job to do. I've discussed in this series, but in other series, there was a certain point in my life. Well, it was pretty much when I met Swami. I realized I was really here for a reason. And that reason was Swami Kriyananda, to learn from him and to pass it on. And it's never changed. I was thinking how many years it's been now. It's been quite a long time, 71. So now this is 2021, June 1st, 1971. That will be 50 years this year. That's the day I moved. I've already passed 50 years because I met Swamiji in 1969. But I started living in ashram on June 1st, 71. So that's a pretty long time. And in an incarnation, not compared to infinity, but in an incarnation. And I do have something I'm supposed to do, and that is to just do this. That's why I do it all the time. This is a debt. It's a huge karmic debt. I was just this sort of bundle of blessings. I was buried in blessings, and my job is to just sort of, pass them on, just take the, unload all that was piled on top of me. I have to finish. I have to empty the pot. I'm not a bazillionaire, but it's sort of the same sort of thing. I have to just make sure that I give it all away before this mouth and mind stop working. Now, what is the point here? Oh, so it may be true that we have things that we have to do. You give birth to a child, you are committed. You have to raise that child. You have a talent for anything. God has given it to us and we need to do it. We have responsibilities, we have talents. But there's only one reason why we're doing those things. And that is so that we inside ourselves can feel closer to God. Because from the point of view of the masters, certainly from the point of view of eternity, it all just comes and goes. But the consciousness of the jiva, of the individual, that is a steadily expanding eternal reality. The civilization you lived in, the geography, the politics, your success or failure in one lifetime from an external perspective, all of that is just literally, it just literally turns to dust. Civilizations rise and fall. They find civilizations at the bottom of the ocean, big buildings at the bottom of the ocean. Ooh, wowie zowie, when I read or think about those things. Or I went to Pompeii. Pompeii is that place in Italy where the volcano Vesuvius just buried the town. And so you have all these bits and pieces of the buried town. I mean, it was there and then Vesuvius just blew its top and then it wasn't. And when you go there, I mean, there's like beautiful mosaic floors and remnants of lovely buildings and just all these different things that shows that there were a lot of people there just thinking they were doing something. Now, all of that went away, but their consciousness did not go away. Their existence and their awareness. Whoever they were who got buried by Vesuvius, they're still tootling along somewhere. Those individual jivas are still just chugging away at their effort to attain God realization, and I hope some of them have gotten there. So one of the things that really mixes up our desire to live intuitively is that we so often think that our intuition is going to give us instructions for things that don't have intuitive answers, or that God is going to express an opinion about something that he really doesn't care about. It's like, it's super important to me who I marry, where I live, whether I have children, what I name my children, just like all these things, they're super important to me. And it's necessary. It's necessary for me to do whatever's given to me as well as I can. Don't think that this is an excuse for schlocky work. It isn't. Because, and I believe I've mentioned this in this context, because our job, the way we get towards self-realization is we become master of the three gunas. And so when we do our assignment badly, it's always because we have allowed tamasic or rajasic energy, which is downward pulling or merely restless energy, to confuse us. And so instead of creating sattvic realities, which are calm, expansive, God-reminding realities, we don't put out enough energy. We don't put out the right kind of energy. Or we let egoic considerations blind us or prevent us from doing what's necessary. Swami writes about this in the Bhagavad Gita commentary. Excellence is required of us. That's why I realized last week I was telling you how I told Swami that one way I could stop being so excellent is to just become less effective. just do everything I did badly, and then there would be no cause for pride. I mean, how did I ever think that was a good idea? But I was a little dopey. So, but he said, no, of course, you have to continually strive for excellence because the effort to achieve excellence is how we develop our inner qualities. You see, the lack of willingness to achieve excellence always means that our consciousness is trapped. And the excellence is the objective way that we can gain access to what our consciousness is doing. Because, I mean, even this mere suggestion, our reasoning is not always reliable because our reasoning just gets all trapped in these weird ideas. And so does our intuition, for that matter, which is the problem here. So, but where I'm trying to go with this is God really has just one intention for us. How much have you loved? There's a beautiful story by Dr. Ritchie. I talk about it often because it's such a great book. It used to be called Return from Tomorrow. Now it has a different name, but it's the same story. It's Dr. something Ritchie, I don't know his first name, who dies. He dies in the Spanish flu right after World War II, and then he's dead for hours, and then he comes back into his body. And when he goes to his life review, he meets Jesus, because Jesus is the way he'd always thought about God. That's who he expected to meet, so Jesus came. And Jesus is there, and Jesus says to him, how much have you loved? And Richie wants to talk to Jesus about all kinds of other things, but Jesus is really not interested in anything. He has one question: how much have you loved? And the answer to that question, Dr. Ritchie was embarrassed to admit, was not very much, not very much. So it doesn't really matter. I mean, it helps if you build a big empire, you know, if you build many big buildings, if you, even if you write wonderful music, I mean, or paint paintings, that's not a waste of time, because the effort to do that will help train your consciousness. But it's training your consciousness for one objective. And that objective is to draw closer to God and to be God's instrument in this world. So sometimes one of the problems we have with living intuitively is we keep demanding that God will answer questions about which, as I said, he has no opinion. Do you want me to marry or not marry? Gosh, that looks awfully important to me. But when we and but God says it doesn't care. I don't care, because you can be either expansive or selfish in both ways of life. So the question is not, you know, what little tiny dimension you're working in. The question is, what are you doing within that dimension? And so when we change the question to, how can I serve? How can I love? Now, that's pretty much it. How can I serve? How can I love? Now, this is a question about which God has a very strong opinion. And most of the time, you see, we can serve and we can love wherever we are. And now I'm sort of bringing myself to something that I'll have to save for the next session we have together, which is the laws of prosperity, basically. Just like gratitude and prosperity. But let me just stay here for a moment, since I can't really get into that today. Let me just hold this for a thought. At a certain point, it occurred to me, because I used to struggle. I used to struggle with great tray, dramatic energy, to struggle to know what God wanted of me. It was all just right in front of my face, but I would struggle it from time to time. To be fair to myself, I got over this pretty early. This was pretty early. I was struggling to know what God wanted of me, and I was really struggling. And Swami's comment, I mean, there's a whole story associated with, but essentially, I thought it was very hard to know what God wanted, and he told me it wasn't. And that was when I began to realize that I was asking the wrong question. There were many questions that were the wrong question, but one of them was, what circumstances should I live in? What should the conditions of my life be? And I would just, that there was, God was silent, because he had no way of answering that question. You know, if somebody asked me a question about I don't know, astrophysics. They can ask me the question from every single angle, and I just can't answer it. It's just not, it's not within my field. Of course, God could answer any question, but he doesn't have an opinion. But as soon as you say, Lord, teach me to love you, help me to serve, you know, not even how can I serve sometimes, but just help me to serve. What is right in front of me that I can give to? How can I give more? How can I be your instrument? You know, who in this world needs your presence, and how can I be that presence for you? Then Divine Mother just opens every possible door, because now we're working together for the single one true goal. And the wonderful thing about that is that once we really start asking the right question and we really start flowing in the right way, that begins to create magnetism. And that magnetism begins to teach us, and other opportunities come from us. When we're sitting there asking, why am I not being recognized? Why am I not being given the position? I want more responsibility. Maybe I'm supposed to do that. Maybe I'm supposed to do this. You know, why are people not letting me? However you're phrasing it, what should I do externally? Then you're just, it's a silence. God is silent. For me, it became not exactly how can I love more, but why am I so afraid? Which is sort of the same question. I was asking the question from reverse. But it was like, I'm very attached to certain outcomes, and I keep pretending, I keep pretending that God isn't guiding me. But God was guiding me extremely well. I just didn't like his answer. It was that classic one, you know, where the man gets to the top of the mountain and asks the sage at the top of the mountain, you know, for some advice, and he doesn't like the advice. He says, is there anyone else here I can talk to? It's just like, now sometimes I have to say this, this is a wonderful story from Master. There was a man working at the lake shrine, and I don't remember the details, but in some way Master gave this man certain instructions, and he didn't want to follow them. So he went and he sat to meditate, and he started praying to Babaji. And Master walked right in, because he could read his mind. And he said, no fair going over my head. So sometimes we can say, is there anybody else I can talk to? Can I get a second opinion on this? But when we find what I figured out, and I figured it out fairly early, if God was not answering me, it wasn't because God didn't want to answer me. It was because the question was the wrong question, and he couldn't answer it. He just couldn't answer it. But when I ask the right question, why am I afraid? How can I overcome my attachments? How can I serve? How can I love more? Oh, then all of a sudden, there's just a flood. But usually the answers are very mundane and not very glamorous. And we prefer dramatic to actual work. That's not true of everyone, but there is this sort of desire, if it's romantic and dramatic, it's more attractive than, how can I serve? Well, why don't you make pancakes for your kids this morning instead of just toast? It's like, oh, really? How can I love more? You know, watching Swami be so patient with his wife. Well, that's how I can love more. You know, he would accept mundane realities and participate in mundane realities that were important to her, and it was part of building the fabric of their life together. Oh, this is how I do. I go shopping, and I actually have an opinion about what dress she buys, because that's how I can be an instrument. It's very interesting to contemplate. That's the simple, childlike, humble devotee. And that's the sweetest kind to God. I'll tell one more story and then I'll stop. There was a man at Mount Washington who was born with nerve damage. Spastic is the word that we used to use, cerebral palsy, whatever it is. And he couldn't talk very well and he couldn't move very well. And Master saw him outside the window and said to Swami, he's very close to God realization. Master, Divine Mother is pleased with his devotion. And Swami, seeing this man who could do very little because of all the physical impairments he had, all he could think of when Master said, Divine Mother is pleased with his devotion, Swami said, it must be a very simple kind of devotion, because the instrument was so impaired, he couldn't express it in any sophisticated manner. Master Swami said, smiled so sweetly, and he said, ah, yes, that's the kind that pleases Divine Mother the most. You see, so we have to really begin to see it from Divine Mother's point of view. Okay, my friends, I'll talk to you soon again.